Taste of Home Cooking School is coming to Barrie. Grab your friends, your family, your neighbor, and join them at the Barrie Opera House on Tuesday, April 28th, for a fun-filled cooking experience. With cooking demonstrations by Chef Amanda, you'll learn seasonal recipes that are perfect for every skill level. Every attendee receives a goodie bag loaded with products from the national sponsors and coupons. General admission tickets are $15. Only 50 VIP tickets are available. For $35, VIPs get a meet and greet with the chef prior to the show, appetizers, and more. Visit BarrieOperaHouse.org to get your tickets.
It's time to get the story behind the story. Interviews with newsmakers, newsbreakers, and your phone calls. Radio Vermont presents The Mark Johnson Show.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the program. Thanks for tuning in. Beautiful day out there today. Thanks for spending part of it with us. We're broadcasting live. We're out on the road today. We are at Norwich University. It is the 20th Colby Military Writers Symposium. As we do each and every year when we broadcast here live from the Sullivan Museum, we have a great lineup of folks that are going to be joining us on the program today. In fact, coming up later this hour, we'll talk with Lewis Sorley. He's the author of A Better War. He writes about the Vietnam conflict and, in fact, says it was a his conclusion, a failed endeavor. So we will talk with him. Coming up later on this hour. Coming up next hour, we're going to be concluding the program with one of the founders of this program, Ed Tracy, who is now out in Chicago, who works at the Pritzker Library. We actually broadcast live from there some years back. So he is back here celebrating the 20th anniversary. We'll catch up with him. He's an award-winning television and webcast producer, first executive director here at the Colby Symposium. Later, and also coming up in our second hour this morning, after we check in with our White House crew, we'll chat with Sherry Caddy, who is an alumna and is works on cybersecurity issues. She's, in fact, the Director for Cybersecurity Policy, Integration, and Outreach at the National Security Council at the White House. So that'll be coming up in our second hour this morning. Now, let me remind you, you are welcome to join us on the program. I know sometimes when we're out on the road that you think it's somehow an inconvenience to join us or it's any different or more difficult to do. It is not. All you have to do is pick up your phone the same way you can join us on the program when I'm back live at the studio. And call us at the usual phone number. So you can call us at 244-1777. That's our local number in central Vermont. And you can also reach us on our toll-free lines at 877-291-8255. Again, let me give you those numbers. 877-291-TALK is the easiest toll-free number for you to reach us. We begin this morning with the 2015 Colby Award winner, and congratulations this morning to Douglas Mastriano, who is the author of Alvin York, A New Biography of the Hero of the Argonne. Thank you for joining us. Congratulations.
Good morning, and thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So let's find out a little bit about your background. You now work down at the U.S. Army War College. So tell us, what do you do down there, Douglas?
Yeah, at the U.S. Army War College, we train the upcoming leaders of the nation and how to conduct strategy. And so my focus is military strategy, plans, and operations. That's a mouthful.
Okay.
But the bottom line is if we have to intervene somewhere or not, how to shape a theater, what do these officers need to think about? Not just war. But what can you do to avert war on the front end? And God forbid, when the phase comes for combat, what are all the aspects you need to bring in, not just the military instrument of power, but also the diplomatic, the economic, and the informational?
Okay. Is there a plan for every part of the world?
There are contingencies for key areas, but not every part of the world.
Okay. How do you determine what to focus on?
We have theater commanders out there. So, for instance, in Europe, we have the European commander under EUCOM, European Command, and based out of Stuttgart, Germany, that commander and his staff decide which regions, based off the guidance from the president and the Joint Chiefs of Staff, to plan for.
Mm-hmm. What's you mentioned that there's work that's done ahead of time to try to avert war. What's taught? What's exposed to the students on that?
Yes. So stability and security are key components of national statehood, Okay, what we see in Yemen is an example of internal security collapsing. Mm-hmm. So one of the key aspects that we promote or teach is foreign internal defense, where we provide equipment, training, professionalism to the force to try to reduce blackmail and corruption. And in that, you create an environment where a nation hopefully can remain stable and not need foreign intervention to prop it up.
Okay. This whole idea of failed states, you know, is one that's a relatively, seems like it's a relatively new concept. I mean, I think of Somalia, I think of Yemen, but, you know, growing up, I don't remember this ever happening before.
So what happened since then? It was the end of the bipolar world. The United States facing off against the Soviet Empire, and the U.S. invested a lot of money to prop up its friends and allies, and the Soviets used a lot of their money and resources to prop up friends and allies. And those investments have since left, obviously, since the end of the collapse of the Soviet Union in the early 90s. And a lot of nations had to fend on their own, and many can't. And to make matters worse, it's almost like a house of cards or maybe a row of dominoes. You have an instability in Somalia, and you see it, as we saw tragically last week in Kenya, where it spills over,
right,
and 147, 148 students are massacred.
Right. Tell us about your service in Iraq and Afghanistan.
My service in Iraq happened at the heels of the Cold War. I was serving in Germany with the 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment out of Nuremberg. Saw the Iron Curtain come down. Fascinating time to be there. It was brilliant. It was a highlight of my life to see formerly enslaved people from East Germany and Czechoslovakia come across the border and experience freedom for the first time. And you could see in their eyes. It was a glow. And I thought, wow, it can't get any better than this. Of course, that August in 1990, Saddam decided to invade Kuwait, and we ended up going down with the rest of the 7th Corps. And we helped push the Iraqi forces out, and then rolling through Kuwait City and being welcomed by the local people, the Kuwaitis, who had been enslaved for 7-8 months and now were free, was another highlight in my life. And that was my time with the 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment. It was a tough fight. We left the main, led the main attack for 82 hours for the main push in theater. Took on Saddam's Iraqi Republican Guards, his best armored forces. These guys did fight, not the propaganda you see on TV where people just throwing their arms down. That did happen elsewhere, but not in front of us. And a lot of close calls. God definitely delivered me from, got me out of there alive, and then moved on to regular assignments. And of course, 9/11 happens, and ended up serving 3 times in Afghanistan, each time in a NATO billet with NATO in Afghanistan. So my last time, I was the director of the Joint Intel Center in Kabul, and I had soldiers from 18 nations working for me. And it's of course challenging to lead people with different ethnic backgrounds, different national interests, but it's extremely rewarding to navigate that process and to have so many friends along our side to help us in that very important fight.
Wow, 3 tours, that sounds like a lot.
It was, but not as many as some. There's some who've gone a lot more than I have. In fact, one of the Danish soldiers that I served with 3 times in Afghanistan, this is a guy from Denmark. I don't hear much about this,
yeah,
but he did 8 tours altogether.
Wow, wow.
So, yeah, there's a lot of people out there committing a lot of their time, not just Americans.
Uh-huh. Go back here when the wall fell. Tell me about, were you out in the streets at night when this was happening? Tell me about that.
Well, I was, I had a military intelligence company with Russian, Czechoslovakian, and German linguists. So our duty was on the border to listen to what the Soviets were doing.
Wow.
And,
oh, my gosh. Huh.
We were on the border, and shortly after when it came down, so it was a few days had passed when we had a border mission, and as we were coming off of our mission, me and my soldiers, one of our vehicles broke down on the Autobahn, so we pulled over at a rest stop. The brakes went out, and we're getting it fixed, and a busload of East Germans showed up, and they were looking at us, all these strapping Americans with their M16s looking pretty tough, and they were afraid.
Uh-huh.
So I went over and started talking to them in German, and they all got poured off the bus and gathered around me with this look of joy in their eyes. I couldn't believe it.
Wow.
And it's like, wow. Somebody who'd experienced enslavement under the Soviet Marxist system and then experiencing freedom for the first time, and you could see it in their eyes. And I was like, you know, what we've done and sacrificed over the years was worth it.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Douglas Mastriano. He's the 2015 Colby Writers Symposium winner. Let's talk a little bit about your book. I think many of us are familiar with Alvin York from Gary Cooper fame. So why'd you decide to write about Alvin York? And tell our listeners, who was Alvin York?
Okay, Alvin York is the most celebrated American doughboy from the First World War. Few people know anything about World War I. And it started in 1914. We're in the middle of the centennial for the second year of the war now. And in fact, in a week or two is Anzac Day, Australia and New Zealand Day, when they launched their first bloody attack against the Turks in Gallipoli, a failed attack under the British Empire. But okay, Alvin York, one of the most highly decorated American soldiers of the First World War, and the guy was amazing. And the thing that troubled me about York was probably maybe something that stuck in your mind, the movie. In that genre of movies, you have John Wayne, rough and tough, go get him. He's going to be a hero, you know it.
Right.
And then I watched this movie when I was a young man with my dad, Sergeant York, the movie, of Gary Cooper playing Alvin York. And it really troubled me that Alvin York didn't want to be in the Army, didn't want to be a hero, and tried to get out of serving in the Army because of his Christian beliefs.
Correct.
So that kind of drew me in. Why is this guy so different? Because didn't want to be a hero, but look what he did. He captured 132 Germans who were fighting. They didn't want to throw the bag in yet. Took out a German machine gun, took out a German bayonet attack, and saved the 82nd Division, today the 82nd Airborne Division, from defeat on that awful day in 8 October 1918 when his unit attacked into that trap. And as I dug deeper, I was intrigued more and more by the York story. A man raised in a Christian family, his dad dies in 1911. He's responsible for the farm, rejects the Christian beliefs, becomes a partier, goes up to the Kentucky border to get drunk every weekend, Friday through Sunday getting drunk. And those drinking establishments of the time were called Blind Tigers. And just like you see in a movie built on the Kentucky-Tennessee border with a line down the middle, so it was. So when the police showed up from Tennessee, you just staggered over to the Kentucky side and kept drinking, and vice versa.
Wow.
And they were rough places. They were shootouts, knife fights, usually over women, or just a bunch of raucous young men with a lot of barley brew in their belly. And so York's life wasn't going so well. All his family was concerned about him. The neighbors were concerned as well. Things weren't going well for him at all. The law was after him because he was doing a lot of things he ought not to. Always getting into fights. And then a neighbor girl caught his eye. Her name was Gracie Williams. And the only way he could see Gracie was to go to church because her dad was a strong Christian, an elder in the church, in fact. And so he was going to church. And one January 1915, they had a revival service. They had a guest preacher from Indiana down, a saddlebag preacher. They traveled on horses with saddlebags full of Bibles. And he heard the gospel and went forward and got saved, and his life changed. And he stopped drinking, put down the bottle for the Bible. And so that was a turning point in his life.
Yeah.
And he became an elder in that church, was leading Sunday school for the kids. Everyone was amazed in the transformation of his life. And then 2 years later, he's drafted into the Army. And when he read, "Thou shalt not kill," in the Old Testament, he's like, "I can't serve in the Army. I can't kill Germans. It's against my beliefs." So what does he do with his moral dilemma? Apply for conscientious objection. Was turned down three times, local, state, and federal level. He had to serve.
And then, so he spoke with his commanding officer, I remember, before he actually went into service to try to reconcile this conflict. What happened in that discussion?
So he reported to duty at Camp Gordon, Georgia, in 1917, and his company commander was Captain Danforth, and his battalion commander was Major Buxton, both also Christians. And York was now in a lot of confusion. How can you guys as Christians, violate the first commandment, thou shalt not kill? And so they walked him, second commandment, so they walked him through this moral dilemma. And York said it was a great discussion. It wasn't debating, shouting. It was a discussion how a Christian can fight or why a Christian can't from York's perspective. And in the end, Captain Danforth read from Ezekiel chapter 33 in the Old Testament. And basically, that scripture says God appoints his people as watchmen on the wall, and if you don't warn your people about danger, he will hold you accountable for their blood on your hands. It's as if you killed him yourself. So York said, okay, I'm satisfied. So he was willing to serve his country and die for his country, but not kill. So he stayed in the Army.
Mm-hmm. You also, one of the other reasons that you wrote this book is to sort of separate the fact from the fiction. What were you able to figure out in terms of what York's accomplishments were that were real and the ones that weren't real?
The York story is just so incredible because we have this guy who enters that fight on 8 October 1918, willing to die for his country but not kill. And he said so right before the battle. And obviously his fellow soldiers are like, okay, can we count on him?
Mm-hmm.
And then when that German machine gun opened fire, when they broke through the line, him and 16 others, and a German machine gun opened fire and killed or wounded 9 of the 17 Americans, York was left in command. He was a corporal, his last non-commissioned officer, not dead or wounded. And he looked around, and they had a bunch of German prisoners at the time. He saw dead and dying Americans and Germans. But worse yet, he looked over to his right, and he saw his best friend, Murray Savage, chopped almost in half by machine gun bullets. And he said to himself, I got to stop the killing. So that's when he charged up the hill, took out that German machine gun position. It was all about his friends and trying to save lives. It's an amazing dichotomy. It's so ironic.
Right.
And then I learned on the other side, what about the Germans? Why did the Lieutenant Commander Paul Fulmer on the other side give the order for the rest of the Germans to surrender? Well, as York ran up the hill, took out that German machine gun and its supporting infantry, about 19 soldiers he shot there. That's about a platoon.
Mm-hmm.
He came back down the hill where the German prisoners were stacked on top of the surviving Americans, trying not to get hit by the machine gun. And as York was running back down the hill to rejoin the men and the prisoners, a German officer, Fritz Endress, led a bayonet attack against York. So York slid on his side, dropped his rifle, pulled out his sidearm, a Colt automatic pistol, and started picking the Germans off from back to front, an old hunting trick he learned shooting turkeys. And the last guy to fall was Fritz Endress, who York shot literally at his feet, 6 feet away. York hit him in the abs with the Colt 45, powerful gun, threw Fritz Endress down backwards, and Fritz is on the ground screaming for help. He's best friends with that German commander, Lieutenant Fulmer, who York has as prisoner. Fulmer wants to save Fritz Endress's life. So during this melee, Fulmer cautiously walks over behind York and yells, English? Do you speak English? English? York, being a simple country boy, thinks he's asking him, are you English? He goes, no, I'm American. And Paul Fulmer says, good Lord, if you stop shooting, I'll have them surrender. So if York doesn't know what's going on now, this German guy speaks perfect English with almost a Chicago accent, because he lived in Chicago for a while. It's okay, go ahead and do it. And sure enough, Paul Fulmer blows a whistle, and the Germans on the hill surrender, but it was only to save the life of Fritz Endress. It wasn't because they lost their will to fight or any other silly things you hear these days. What else about York? He had good help. There was a machine gunner with York. His name was Private Percy Beardsley, up this way in New England. And Percy had a French light machine gun, a Chauchat machine gun. Since America wasn't prepared for war, we had to borrow and beg equipment from our allies. And this machine gun was unreliable. It constantly jammed. It had an open magazine. And during this fight, it jammed, and he couldn't get it to shoot. So he had a sidearm also, another Colt automatic pistol. And as York was fighting off the bayonet attack, guess what? He had help from Private Percy Beardsley. Percy said so in the affidavits during the investigation, but it seems like the Army kind of just ignored or overlooked that. And he was such a quiet, humble guy that he didn't beat his own chest or blow his own horn on us. He just kind of let it go. So we have a second hero here.
Mm-hmm. How do you know all of this is true? How do you figure out what's true in 1918?
Yeah, so we're a century on, and we're talking with a high degree of certainty as to what may have happened. Some of it's circumstantial, but we did an integrated approach to this research. First, it was looking at what the archives said. Started off in the American archives, as all researchers on York had done. But then another twist. I was the first and only a researcher to hit the German archives. And guess what? The records had survived World War II, and when they brought them out, it was like a scene from Indiana Jones with a string tied around it and layers of dust, and there was maps in there. And German commentary as what happened that morning. And the German perspective by name, where, with landmarks. Okay, so I overlaid those. There was some conflict in those sources, as you'd normally find, but the Germans had a very clear picture they were defending. Okay, so we have that. Then we went out to the battlefield and started looking at the ground. And seeing, okay, Germans say a machine gun was here. Does it make sense?
Mm-hmm.
And if not, why?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that was a third layer. And then another layer was the archaeology. Received permission from the French to get metal detectors, spent 100 days of metal detecting out there.
Wow.
And a story, as it's coming out of the ground, and it's making a story come alive. It was fantastic. And then, okay, so that's interpretive history now. Let's take it to the scientific level. Shipped off the key artifacts at Dr. Doug Scott, I would say the world's premier forensics analysis on historical artifacts, and he's University of Nebraska. And Doug Scott verified that the artifacts we have came out of the right types of weapons that York would have had. So it's a high degree of certainty that we can say, yeah, it happened this way. Okay, so Private Percy Beardsley, we pulled up out of the ground. Now, this isn't 4 years of battling back and forth. As some people have visioned, the Americans have broken out on the 26th of September, 1918. So we're in open warfare now. This is only York's battle. It's not contaminated by other engagements. Mm-hmm. There's no long trench lines as you see in the movie. We're in a forest with beautiful trees that have been there since Noah's days. It's just a beautiful, it's still beautiful, the Argonne Forest. And so we shipped off the pistol casings, Colt automatic 45 casings to Dr. Doug Scott. And lo and behold, nine of those were fired from a different weapon, Percy Beardsley's weapon. Now, there's rumors going around that sidearm is still in the Beardsley family. If we can get a hold of that and have that analyzed ballistically and maybe match them up.
Huh. And so you're going back there. Is that part of what you're going to do when you go back there, try to find that?
Next week I'm going to France, but it's the Lee Battlefield Tours. So I'll be back on the York spot, but I won't have a metal detector in hand. It'll be to show an army organization stationed in Europe what happened.
Okay. Is there any applicability to his story to today?
Absolutely. So it's a fascinating tale. And for some people, it's like, okay, that's 100 years ago. So what?
Right.
The so what is the York story says a lot to Americans and people around the world today. It's a story of redemption. We have a guy who lost all hope, whose life had fallen apart, drinking himself to sleep every weekend, spending all his money on booze and chasing women and getting in gun and knife fights. And then his life changed. And what a difference that can make. Okay, so 1915, he became a Christian. And he said it was really hard to turn down his friends on Friday night when they'd come by and say, hey, Alvin, why don't you join us at the Blind Tigers just down the road 5 miles?
Yeah.
He says, well, it was really tough to say no. But each time he said no, it became easier. And he built what I say is his character muscle. So he became a brave, heroic man on the inside first. So on 8 October 1918, just a few years later, we just saw an outward manifestation of the man he chose to become. And this is why it's important. And I hope this inspires young people today, young and old alike. We all need this lesson. But we can determine how we're going to be in that time of crisis, maybe not in warfare, but maybe in a family crisis or a job situation where you're being tested with compromising your integrity, your character.
Yep.
And if you'd practice throughout your life, or even a couple of years in York's case, of building moral character, you'll make the right decision when the time comes.
Thank you for your time this morning, and congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Douglas Mastriano is the author of Alvin York, a new biography of the hero of the Argonne. We're going to take a short commercial break. We'll be back. We're broadcasting live this morning from the Sullivan Museum here on the campus of Norwich University. It's the Colby Military Writers Symposium. Back after this.
April is one of the best times of the year to drive a new Nissan. Jack Castellaneta, it seems like everyone has some kind of sale, but even their sale prices don't beat a Formula Nissan deal.
If you've ever wondered why so many people are driving cars and trucks from Formula Nissan, come find out in April. Our simple, straightforward, factory direct pricing means you get more car for less money, period.
You're taking up to $5,500 right off the MSRP of select new Nissans, and when you add on exclusive Formula Nissan discounts, nobody can match these prices.
Check the newspapers, check the internet. You won't find a better deal anywhere. And our selection compares with some of the largest dealers in New England.
Straightforward, factory direct pricing, all the selection you need, and exclusive Formula Nissan discounts. It all adds up to April being the best time of the year to drive a new Nissan for less.
We're on the Barry Montpelier Road next to Pizza Hut and at FormulaNissan.com. Let us show you how easy it is to do business here.
RB Technologies on Route 14 East Montpelier has been creating and supporting thoughtfully designed, custom-crafted computer networks for their clients since 1997. Here's Peter Timponi from the Vermont College of Fine Arts.
Ruben and all of his crew have been working with us over the last 2.5 years. We recently had some electrical damage in the building, which took down the entire network, and they were in helping us the next day. It was a real, real pleasure working with them. It helped us out a ton. Here at Vermont College, we're a small operation, our IT department. We only have 2 people, so it's often hard sometimes to find the right bit of knowledge that we might need. So I have actually called Ruben before and spoke with them about, you know, things that I'm trying to do, things that I'm trying to accomplish, and they've been very helpful in guiding us along the way. Friendly, courteous, knowledgeable are the first 3 words that come to my head when I think about Ruben and everyone there, and they're a great, great crew.
RB Technologies cares about their customers. Call them at 223-4448 or online at rbtechvt.com. RB Technologies, efficiency through technology.
My name is Sharon, and this is why you need to put your cell phones down. My son was 18 years old, and we had seen him many times pick up his phone and change his music while he was driving, as much as we railed against that. He drifted over into the other lane. When he looked up, he was face to face with a tractor trailer truck, a milk truck, and Spencer died instantly. 5 seconds. 5 seconds. That's all it took for him to die. You don't realize what can happen in 5 seconds. And before you have to find out, put your phone down. Visit highwaysafety.vermont.gov/phonesdown.
Are you a flavor junkie? Do you have discerning taste or just really opinionated taste buds? Well, if so, and you're 18 or older, the Keurig Green Mountain Sensory Test Center wants to hear from you. Join us at our facility in Waterbury Center for ongoing tasting sessions. And be the first to experience innovative foods, beverages, and other products before you see them in the grocery aisle. Tasting sessions happen every week and only take 30 to 45 minutes. Each time you visit, you'll receive rewards such as Amazon gift cards and Keurig.com discounts, plus incentives to shop and eat locally while you're in town. Who doesn't want the opportunity to have fun and get rewarded at the same time? All you have to do is tell us what you think. There's no experience necessary to participate. You just need to be 18 or older and love trying new things. Become a Keurig Green Mountain taste tester today and let your voice be heard. Give us a call at 882-2500 and don't forget to tell your friends.
All right, we're back broadcasting live today at Norwich University. Thank you for joining us on the program. It's the 20th anniversary of the Colby Military Writers Symposium. One of the hallmarks of this event happens tomorrow. It is the public session, and the topics are usually really right on point and really quite interesting. And tomorrow, no exception. Here's the deal. Coming up tomorrow, 1 o'clock, you do not need to sign up ahead of time or anything for this. You can just show up for this, and the discussion will be about cyber warfare and privacy. How do we keep the balance between the rights of citizens and the security of the nation? I mean, you know, can you find anything that's more on topic than that? Oh, my goodness. All right. Speaking of on topic, let me take a moment of your time to tell you about one of our fabulous sponsors on the program. Our friends at Jamison Insurance are standing by right now. Operators standing by at their phones to help you with your insurance needs. You may not need insurance today, understandable. You don't buy a used car every day. But if you do, before you leave the lot or before you leave the house of the person that you buy it from, give somebody like Jamison Insurance a call so that if you have an accident on the way home, you don't have that ultimate embarrassment. So the other deal is that you may not need insurance today, but they'd be happy to review the policies that you currently have in place. And they will do that over the phone. If you're an individual, they'd be happy to make that happen for you. If you own a business, call John Jamison. He owns the family business, and he will come to your office to do a review. You can leave out all the folders of all the paperwork, you know, all that insurance paperwork. I know you've read all the fine details on that. Here's the good thing. John actually reads all that stuff. So he'll go through your policies, find you the best possible deal, and write up a short report for you and let you know whether or not you're getting the best deal that you can. And you can set up that appointment by giving him a call at 496-2080. 496-2080 is his phone number. You can also get a lot more information about these folks online at jamisoninsurance.com. There's one other event that's going on today, too, that may pique your interest. Those of you in particular that are Abe Lincoln fans, a really interesting discussion is going to be happening. The senior curator of the Aeronautics Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum, which I have to tell you, you know, is one of the most awesome museums on the planet. I was just there about 2 months ago. And so Tom Crouch, who is the senior curator there, is up here today for a lunchtime event here at the Sullivan. He's going to be a guest of the Sullivan Museum. And it's going to be about Mr. Lincoln's Air Force, military aeronautics in the Civil War. I mean, come on, seriously. How could you not want to go to an event like that? And it's going to be happening at the Milano Ballroom, which I'll find out from our friends here exactly where that's located on campus. So if you want to attend that, that's a special lunch and learn event. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll chat with Lewis Sorley. We'll talk about his book, A Better War. Also, we'll get some of the thoughts and comments that I'll share with the panel coming up tomorrow. And we'll be back right after these important announcements.
Vermont is a tight-knit community. We want our small businesses to thrive, and we want what's best for our families and our children. That's why Vermont needs to pass a bill allowing working families to earn paid sick days. Paid leave allows parents to care for a sick child without losing a paycheck, or worse, their job. And business owners who offer paid sick leave can count on a more reliable workforce. Everybody benefits from paid sick days. We need our legislators to support the Healthy Workplaces Bill. Visit vtpaidsickdays.org. To take action today.
Paid for by the Vermont Paid Sick Days Coalition.
Kingdom County Productions presents the timeless classic ballet, Giselle, performed by the Russian National Ballet. Showtime is 7 p.m. Thursday, April 9th, Linden Institute Auditorium. The Washington Post calls the Russian National Ballet the real thing. Tickets start at $18 with discounts for students and senior citizens, now on sale at Catamount Regional Box Office or by calling 748-2600. Online sales at kingdomcounty.org. Don't miss a ballet for the ages, Giselle, Thursday, April 9th, Linden Institute. Sponsors include Linden State College, Passumpsic Savings Bank, Cabot Creamery, Linden Institute, Blue Cross Blue Shield of Vermont, Q Burke Mountain Resort, Catamount Arts, Community National Bank, Miss Lindenville Diner, Union Bank, NVRH, Silver Mountain Graphics, Jake and Kathy Wheeler, Abel Toll and Ronnie Lister of the Auto Saver Group, and WDEV Radio Vermont. Don't miss A Ballet for the Ages, Giselle, performed by the Russian National Ballet, Thursday, April 9th, Linden Institute. Information at kingdomcounty.org.
Come to the Made in Vermont Marketplace, April 10th through the 12th. A weekend of fun featuring Vermont-made furniture, specialty foods, crafts, lighting, and more. Plus, raffles and giveaways. And of course, the Vermont Spirits Room featuring Vermont's finest distilleries, vineyards, and breweries. The Made in Vermont Marketplace, April 10th through the 12th at the Champlain Valley Expo. Presented by Vermont Business Magazine. For information and a dollar off coupon, go to madeinvermontmarketplace.com.
We're back broadcasting live this morning at Norwich University. It's the 20th anniversary of the Colby Military Writers Symposium. And again, just a couple of notes here for you. Coming up tomorrow afternoon, 1 to 3 p.m., is the public panel discussion, Cyber Warfare and Privacy. How do we keep the balance between the rights of citizens and the security of the nation? And there will be a number of panelists that will be on that. In fact, a couple of them are going to be joined by today. Also today, a reminder that that event that's coming up at noontime, and that's the one that involves Tom Crouch, who's the senior curator down at the Air and Space Museum, who will be talking about Mr. Lincoln's Air Force. What a concept. I mean, how could you not want to go to an event like that? let's give a nice warm Radio Vermont welcome this morning to Lewis Bob Sorley, who is the author of A Better War, and the Unexamined Victories and Final Tragedy of America's Last Years in Vietnam. And Bob is also going to be on the panel tomorrow. Who knew that Abe Lincoln had an Air Force, huh? What a story.
I guess if you got anything can lift off the ground, even like a balloon, you could call it the Air Force of the day.
There you go. So before we start here, tell us, I'm sitting in front of this beautiful portrait. It's kind of making me look, diminishing me. This portrait of General Isaac Davis White. Who is General Isaac Davis White, Bob?
I.D. White, as he was always called, was one of the leading officers of his generation. I see him in the portrait wearing four stars and the shoulder patch of 8th Army, which was our command in the Pacific in the days when he was prominent. And as we said in just chatting for a moment beforehand, in his day, the very senior officers were, in the main, very austere in their demeanor, and their relationships with their subordinates were very formal. And he was a little more approachable than most, but no less effective. And I think he helped to put us on a track where a better style of leadership, at least as I would view it, has become the norm.
Mm-hmm. Your background includes you served in the U.S. Army, you were on the staff of the Pentagon, later a senior civilian official at the Central Intelligence Agency. Did you overlap with Bill Colby?
I got to know Bill Colby very well, but not at CIA. I came along there soon after his tenure as director. In fact, you know what it's like trying to break into a new culture sort of at mid-career or mid-life. And right away, people wanted you to declare that you were either a Helms man or a Colby man.
Okay.
I was decidedly a Colby man from the beginning. The way I got to know him was my work on a biography of a general named Creighton Abrams.
Mm-hmm.
Abrams had commanded in Vietnam to good effect, much better effect than his predecessor, and Colby became his deputy for support of pacification, which he did brilliantly. And luckily for me, Mr. Colby and I got to be friends as well as have these professional interactions. I thought he was a superstar.
Mm-hmm.
And very sorry he's gone.
You ultimately conclude in your book that Vietnam was a failed endeavor. How did you reach that conclusion?
Before I get to that in the book, I say there came a point at which the war was won. I say the fighting wasn't over, but the war was won, and the reason it was won is that we had enabled the South Vietnamese, so long as we kept our commitments to them, a crucial conditional, to maintain their freedom and independence, which they were doing very well. Later, of course, I have to explain how there came a point at which the war was no longer won, and that was the point at which we had withdrawn our forces pursuant to the terms of the so-called Paris Accords,
mm-hmm.
and the South Vietnamese fought on, but the United States Congress, in its wisdom, decided that we should no longer keep the commitments we had made to them, and when we stopped supporting them, while the North Vietnamese got in greatly increased support from their patrons, who were China and the Soviet Union, the outcome was no longer in doubt. I had a friend named Tom Polgar, who was the last CIA chief of station Saigon. And in his, I believe it was his last cable, he says something like this: outcome no longer in doubt, because South Vietnam cannot carry on without our support so long as the North continues to get robust support from its communist backers. End of message, end of story.
Hmm.
So it didn't, I am always... say with conviction that it didn't have to end that way.
What was the peak? At what point did America really, would you say, have an ability to have claimed victory?
In the book, I think I date that about late 1970, after the Cambodian incursion. Most people probably know by now that there were two main parts to our involvement there. The first part: a general named William Westmoreland is commanding our forces in Vietnam, and he's constantly asking for more and more troops, and for a long time he's getting them. So we build up our commitment there, well over 500,000 soldiers.
543,000. It's breathtaking when you think about it.
It is. And then, you know, what's really breathtaking is the poor use that was made of those soldiers by General Westmoreland. So finally, after a major offensive mounted by the enemy, which we call Tet 1968, finally a change is made, and Westmoreland's brought home. Creighton Abrams becomes our commander there, and he has an entirely different view of the nature of the war and how it should be fought. Westmoreland had wanted to fight a war of attrition, a war of the big battalions, and in doing that, he neglected pacification, and he neglected upgrading South Vietnam's armed forces. Abrams thought it should be one war in which all three of those things, military operations, but much changed, support for the South Vietnamese armed forces and support for pacification, had equal importance and should get equal emphasis. So just the opposite of the first period, now we, with Mr. Nixon now as president, we decide to unilaterally, incrementally withdraw U.S. forces. So during Abrams' period of command, he has fewer and fewer forces to deal with, just the opposite of Westmoreland having more and more forces to deal with, and yet things are going much better. And so guess what? The reason they are going much better is he is now helping the Vietnamese to take on more and more of the burden. By the time they get to the what we refer to as the Easter Offensive of 1972, virtually all U.S. combat forces have been withdrawn, and Abrams, this is ironic, Abrams, this great armor leader from World War II, has only air power and naval gunfire to support the South Vietnamese. And he does support them very effectively, and they throw back the enemy's invasion of about 20 division equivalent so effectively that it's three more years before they can mount another major offensive of that kind, by which time we pull the plug.
Mm-hmm.
So critics then said, well, the South Vietnamese couldn't have sustained themselves without our help, and it was air power they were talking about primarily. Abrams wouldn't hear of it. He said 10 times the air power wouldn't have carried the day if the Vietnamese had not stood and fought as they did. And he was very proud of them. So the two halves of the war are almost diametrically opposed in practically any terms that you care to apply. And for a long time, nobody seemed to know that. The best-known books about the war treated it as though our involvement was a homogeneous whole.
Mm-hmm.
And that whole was like it was under Westmoreland.
Mm-hmm.
So if the book A Better War did anything for us, it was to make very clear that the two halves of the war were quite different in almost every respect, and especially quite different in their outcome.
We're talking with Bob Sorley, the author of A Better War, The Unexamined Victories and Final Tragedy of America's Last Years in Vietnam. You're welcome to join us at 244-1777 is our local number, toll-free 877-291-8255. You know, when I listen to you talk about the attempts to try to train and prop up and support the South Vietnamese Army, you know, I can't help but think about Afghanistan, Iraq, same kind of effort that we've tried to do, and with limited success.
When I go around and talk, which I still get invitations to do from time to time, and I'm asked about Afghanistan and Iraq, I try to plead ignorance.
Okay.
But when cornered, I usually say something like the following. You have to be familiar with my analysis of the war in Vietnam to credit what I'm going to say about Vietnam, and then contrast that with Iraq and Afghanistan. But the fact is that by late in the war, South Vietnam had a pretty effective central government. It had a quite effective military establishment, and it had a relatively homogeneous a body politic. And when I look at Iraq and Afghanistan, which I pretend to no expertise on, but mm-hmm. but everything we hear and read about it, miserable central government, miserable armed forces, and totally fragmented body politic, you know, tribal politics, no national body politic. And so the things that I think were essential and enabled Vietnam to succeed, as I have argued they did, until we pulled the plug on them, simply don't seem to me to exist in Iraq and Afghanistan. And so my expectations for those endeavors have always been very low.
Mm-hmm.
I would, of course, love to be proven wrong on that, but so far that doesn't seem to be the way it's going.
So when you argue that really in Vietnam there was initially this victory that was sort of a victory snatched from the jaws of defeat, almost, it sounds like, but if ultimately the South Vietnamese Army couldn't prop them or maintain themselves on their own, how can you not ultimately conclude that this would have been a failure no matter what the politicians did?
Because the reality of the war between the North Vietnamese and the South Vietnamese was that neither one of them was able independently to come up with the wherewithal to conduct armed conflict. Both North and South Vietnam were totally dependent on their external patrons for the tools of war. In the North Vietnamese case, it was a communist China and the Soviet Union and some East European countries that provided them the wherewithal, and in the case of South Vietnamese, it was us. And so if one side loses its patron and the other side gets greatly increased support from its patron, just as I said in the Polgar message, end of case. You can't sustain yourself when your source of supplies and armament goes away. When the Paris Accords came along, they were signed in January of 1973.
Mm-hmm.
And they held that outside forces had to be withdrawn. And so the United States withdrew all of its forces by the end of March, late March. And our practically our sole condition at that time was, we give us back our prisoners of war. And so that happened also. But the North Vietnamese were not required to withdraw their forces in the South. So the situation is already pretty difficult. President Chu of South Vietnam and his senior advisors looked with mortal foreboding at that probable outcome of the Paris Accords. And in order to induce them to the South Vietnamese to sign on, President Nixon sent numerous letters to President Chu in which he made commitments and sent numerous emissaries, including Kissinger and Al Haig, to tell the President Chu in person what we would do for them. And basically, it boiled down to three things. One, if there were renewed hostilities, you know, if the North violated the terms of the treaty, Mr. Nixon said he would use military force to punish that. We're talking about B-52s now, not sending troops back in, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Secondly, he said if there were renewed hostilities, the United States would replace South Vietnam's losses of what were called major military systems, like artillery pieces, aircraft, tanks, and so on a one-for-one basis. And guess what? This was as provided for in the Paris Accords. So the Paris Accords foresaw the possibility that there would be renewed hostilities.
Okay.
And the third thing Mr. Nixon promised President Chu was that we would maintain robust financial support for the South Vietnamese for the foreseeable future. When it came to the crunch, we defaulted on all three of those commitments, and the outcome was foreordained.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason we did that was the wisdom of the Congress at that time. And meanwhile, North Vietnam got greatly increased support from its patrons. I think most Americans would cringe to hear it said that the communists, Chinese and Soviet Union were better and more reliable partners and supporters of their of Vietnamese forces than the Democratic Americans were of theirs, but that's the truth.
Okay. And the Congress turned because the American public turned?
That's a very, very good question. And my sense is they were way out ahead of the American public. As late as 74, in polls, now polling data, as you know, has to be approached with some caution, but the polls said that perhaps as many as 60% of the American public wanted us to still continue to support the South Vietnamese as we had promised we would do. In the, what do you call them, by-elections, the non-presidential year elections, mm-hmm. in 74, a lot of anti-war members of the Congress had been elected, and so the Congress that was going
yeah.
to...
And
so,
the, yeah.
So you have to say, well, that does seem to represent the will of the people. So the polling data and the election data may seem to work at cross purposes there.
Plus, they had Watergate.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that. In their memoirs, both President Nixon and Henry Kissinger identify Watergate as the thing that made it impossible for them to carry through on what they'd promised the South Vietnamese. But if you look at the legislative history, at least a year before the denouement of Watergate, the Congress is voting provisions that no more U.S. forces will be supported there. I mean, they really spell it out. In, over, in the waters adjacent to, they don't say under Southeast Asia, but they take every aspect of it they can, and they constrain our ability to carry through on the promises that have been made. So I don't think it was Watergate. I think it was a failure on the part of the administration to bring the Congress into and then in support of the things that had been promised.
Right.
Now you could argue that that was impossible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that couldn't have been done.
Mm-hmm.
I have to acknowledge that that's certainly possible. But the fact is, we bailed out on our guys, and the North continued to get great support from theirs. Their patrons.
You know, but Bob, you know this as well as I do. One of what has happened over time in history is that Vietnam has been held up as a great lesson learned how to not do things. And it sounds like you would reject that.
I think you have to take every case on its merits. And, you know, you can go back and debate the original decision, should we have gone into Vietnam in the first place. And I think you can come down either side of that issue depending on your understanding of the realities of that time. One thing that's clear, you know this very well, is that all this took place in the larger context of the Cold War.
Sure.
And during the Eisenhower administration, a major study had been undertaken to determine how best to deal with the threat of militant communism. And the Eisenhower answer to that was what we refer to as containment. So where communist forces sought to extend the range of their influence and control, it was seen in the interests of the so-called free world to oppose that. Well, Vietnam was one such battlefield. Korea was another such battlefield.
Mm-hmm.
In Central Europe, you may remember the Hungarian uprising, and we had encouraged the East Europeans to do things like that. We even had an annual Captive Nations Week promulgated by the Congress and so on. And to our disgrace, when the Hungarians rise up, we turn our backs on them. Too risky, we think, or some other rationale for not following through on our commitments. So if you think it's a good idea for the free world to oppose the extension of communist control, and you think that Korea and Vietnam were examples of seeking to do that, then I think you would say, all right, if we're going to do it, let's do it effectively. And so we did not do it effectively in the early years because of the shortcomings to which I've already alluded of William C. Westmoreland. You can have a very interesting debate as to why he was kept there so long.
Mm-hmm.
One of the reasons was he wasn't very honest, and so he maintained that he was achieving things that he really was not.
Yep.
And so on. So my great regret is for the South Vietnamese themselves. Almost everybody I know who served in Vietnam, whether they were advisors to the Vietnamese or whether they served in an American unit, has considerable sympathy for the South Vietnamese, and I personally am very impressed by how the million or so expatriate Vietnamese who made their way to our country have conducted themselves here and contributed to our culture and our society in ways I think are very positive.
Thank you for your time this morning. That was a real treat. Thank you. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Bob Sorley is the author of A Better War. It was actually published back in 1999, right?
98 or 90, yes.
Okay, yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's been around a little bit. Better War, and probably only just like Fine Wine. Probably just, it's like one of those books that gets better over time.
Thank you.
He's the author of A Better War, The Unexamined Victories and Final Tragedy of America's Last Years in Vietnam. We're broadcasting live this morning from the Sullivan Museum here on the grounds of the campus of Norwich University. Let me take a moment of your time to remind you about one of our great sponsors on the program, our friends right up the road at Jet Service Envelope. They can help you with any and all of your printing needs, and they are located in Southbury, but it doesn't really matter where they are, because all you have to do is send your projects over to them electronically, and then they will make them happen, and then they even do deliveries too. So it is a little bit different than the old days. Jeff Blow, now running the family business, his grandfather started it, and I dare say it's a whole lot different business than it was back then. So I encourage you to give them a call today at 229-9335. That's 229-9335. They can publish everything that you need, everything from your memoirs. Bob Sorley could have gotten his book published there. You can get yours published there, too. And you can get one of those nice trifold brochures done as well, too.
So give them a call today at 229-9335. And they're also on the web at jetservice-envelope.com. We're going to take a break from the action here. We'll take a break for news. We'll check in with our White House crew. And then we have another couple of great guests coming your way coming up in hour number two. And again, you feel free to join us at 244-1777. That's our local number. And toll free, you can reach us at 877-291-8255. Keep your dial right here. We got another hour to go. This is FM 96.1 WDEV Warren, broadcasting from the top of Sugar Bush, 96.5 in Barrie and Montpelier, 101.9 in the Kingdom, and AM 550 WDEV Waterbury Montpelier.
AP Radio.